Hello everyone and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. My name is David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's series A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And if you're just tuning in for the first time, you should know that you can find all of our episodes at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us, let us know what you think of the show, at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com, right? Or is it Cast of Kings?
I think it's a Cast of Kings.
You think. I'm almost...
Well, Cast of Kings was taken, I think.
That's right. You're right. So it's acastofkings@gmail.com. Now, if you're new to the show, you don't know how we do it here. We talk about Game of Thrones primarily as a television show, meaning that even though Joanna has read all the books, there are no spoilers for any future episodes of Game of Thrones, and that includes any spoilers revealed in the next time on previews on HBO. Now, we got a ton of emails this week about spoilers and how people were arguing that stuff was arguably spoiled last week on A Cast of Kings. And let me just say that we've heard your criticisms loud and clear. And, you know, we're still trying to come up to a good balance in terms of spoilers and insights from the books. But this week we'll be particularly vigilant against...
Super careful.
So, anyway.
We will keep a closer watch on spoilers than the Stark men kept on Jaime Lannister.
That sounds like a good plan.
It's a low bar.
It would be hard not to do that, right, Joanna. So... this episode begins again with Theon being completely humiliated, realizing that Asha has stolen away in the middle of the night with Bran and Rickon and Hodor. And it's just the continual humiliation, the continual emasculation of Theon, who is in way over his head here. What did you think of this sequence, Joanna?
I thought it was great, and I read something this week that I thought was interesting where, and I'm sorry that I can't remember where I read it, but someone was saying that they felt like Theon was surprisingly sort of the heart or the center of this season of Game of Thrones. And I agree in that his storyline has been like the cleanest and the clearest to follow, and we always know what Theon is up to, and as humiliating as it may be, you know, there's none of this easing back on his storyline at all. He's been fairly present throughout the entire season, you know, which is weird because he's not really a character we love, nor is he a character we love to hate. He's this pathetic character, you
but
know?
He is a compelling character nonetheless, I would argue, and I've really enjoyed following his storyline. I mean, you gotta feel bad for the guy, right? He had a bad hand dealt to him. He got stolen away from his parents when he was young, raised in another family, returns home to his own family, and now, like, who is he supposed to choose, really, right? He's screwed either way. And unfortunately, I think he made the wrong choice. Like, if he had stuck with Robb Stark, I think things would have been okay, right? Or at least, he'd at least have some kind of place in whatever thing is developing. But because he chose to go back to his own family, which is an understandable choice, he is just digging himself deeper metaphorically into this hole. And,
right.
And yeah, it's, but it was a catch 22. I want to say it was a thing where there was no good choices. So,
yeah, I mean, I feel like maybe if he had been a bit older, possibly he could have, you know, given the old fuck you to his father and his sister because they were assholes to him from the start. And, you know, but that's something that, you know, a lot of people struggle with is not succumbing to parental criticism and pressure.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's still quite young. And yeah, with some perspective, maybe he could have seen that the Starks were always fairly good to him and they were the obvious choice. But
he didn't
now
have
perspective. Now he's stuck.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. I think it's really wise to compare this to parental overbearingness in general, Joan. I mean, you know, when my mom told me to take out the trash as a teenager, that's what I called back to when I watched this episode. It's like,
yeah,
dude,
you just took sacked Winterfell.
Yeah, sacked Winterfell and burned two children alive. Really, is
yes.
Really kind of what I wanted, how I wanted to react to that situation.
That's how you acted out.
Yeah, that's how I acted out. Yeah,
I see.
So,
dude.
Really, I see a lot of myself in Theon metaphorically. And
I bet you do a better job beheading someone. I have that faith in you.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. So anyway, not
what did you think of that, of the ending? I know this is the beginning of the podcast, and since we started with Theon, like, what did you think of that?
What did I think of the ending? Well, let's just say that I don't know anything about future episodes or future plot developments, but it is typically not like Game of Thrones to have something like the major death of two characters we've known since the beginning of the series transpire off screen.
What you're saying to me is you don't feel like the people of HBO would shy away from the burning and possible tarring of two small children.
I think that is correct.
Okay.
And also the look that Theon gave those kids at the end, the burnt kids, it could have been, oh my God, what have I done burning Rickon and Bran? Or it could have been, oh God, what have I done? I am so far into this deception and I had to kill these two innocent kids and pretend they were Rickon and Bran. You know,
either way, it could have been screwed, either of those. Right?
Yeah, I mean, either way, he is so far gone. It's hard to even describe. I mean, just think of him at the beginning. Think of him 5 episodes ago. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is a guy who, like, yeah, he's like, everything's going well. He's like swearing allegiance to Rob, and then now he's burning kids alive who may not even be his targets. Anyway.
How the mighty have fallen, Theon.
Indeed. Indeed, how the mighty have fallen. So, anyway. Moving on. What else happened this episode? We got a lot more of the Jon Snow and Ygritte storyline.
Yes.
And so Ygritte just really full on with the flirting here and seduction. And you really got to admire the energy she puts into it, especially in what must be a very cold environment. I'm talking about weather-wise, meteorologically. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it is difficult to seduce someone when your body is, like, struggling to reach homeostasis with the environment around you. Do you know what I'm saying?
But apparently it worked because, you know, John had an awkward evening snuggled up to Ygritte. So I was thinking about this, about
how is it awkward? I don't understand.
I think you entrapped me into this last episode. I'm not going to explain things again.
I mean, I think his knife got, like, jammed into her backside a little bit.
Yeah, no, it was his dagger or something.
It was his dagger.
Yeah. Totes.
But other than that, it was fine, right?
Yeah,
it's just like,
it's like uncomfortable physically to have that dagger, and, you know, for both of them. But other than that, it was a typical evening in the wilderness.
I agree. Yeah, seriously. So anyway.
but yes, I admire her efforts. I feel very sad for poor virginal Jon Snow. And I was thinking of, I can't remember, I know what it is in the books, but I can't remember if in the TV show, if Rob is supposed to be a virgin as well. But I kind of feel like the Stark boys did not have a good enough sex education. And it's the root of some of their problems.
You think if they had gotten laid a little bit more often, that the issues that they're facing now would not be facing them, basically.
I think they would be able to cope with these situations a little bit better.
Exception to that rule, Theon, who got laid plenty of times. So, but he's not a Stark child, so.
Right. Yes, maybe getting laid leads you to burn children.
I think what we really find out here is that what you really need is a loving, committed, monogamous relationship. That's really what is going to help you in this show, because you have a situation where Theon, I mean, he just has sex with hookers and, you know, random sea captain's daughters. You know what I'm saying? Like, he doesn't know what it really means to love. You know what I mean, Joanna?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. He needed a strong, healthy marriage, like, you know, Rob and Cersei, something like that. There has to be some,
wait, who? Oh, Robert Baratheon and Cersei.
Yes, sorry, King Robert.
Yes. No, yeah, clearly that was a very functional relationship, and I think if it had been duplicated in Theon, he'd be much better off, so.
What I will say about Ygritte and John in the snow is, there's a famous line from the book that she uttered, which is, "You know nothing, Jon Snow." And so that was like a big, that was a big thing for book readers. I think we were all waiting for her to say that. So that was fun.
I thought she was great, and she was well played, and the performance is great. It's very sort of I was going to say impish, but I didn't want it to be construed for a pun. It's very kind of mischievous, you know. It's very flirtatious, but also obnoxious at the same time. And I think she strikes just the right balance. Like, I didn't get sick of this character.
No, I really like her.
Yeah.
And yes, I really like her.
Yeah. But yeah, Jon Snow, man, he just cannot catch a break in this Night Watch thing. He just keeps messing up. And it's really cost him dearly this time. Last week, Miles McNutt remarked on how in the books, Jon Snow is younger. And I think, you know, here this week with the whole virginal thing, like, you really see, like, if he had been younger, it might have been maybe more plausible. But I do like that the fact that he's older adds slightly more drama to it and more gravitas to a situation that is otherwise kind of, I don't know, you know,
slapstickish.
Yeah, slapstick. You know, just like talking about sex while you're in the wait. And you know, she's like, "Yeah, like, let's, you know, you can take me right now." And he's like, "What, like here, like in the middle of this huge like pile of mud?" You know, like, logistically, it would be challenging, is what I'm saying. You know?
Yes. Yes.
Logistically, like, making that work is difficult. So.
Correct.
So
correct.
Anyway, all right. enough talk about that. Enough talk about that.
The logistics of mud sex.
Exactly. Especially right. When it's like freezing cold outside. I will say it. Every single week, that location, which I believe is Iceland, right, looks more beautiful than it did the previous week. It's just so amazing. And
I was wondering, because I feel like every scene they shoot there is either at sunset or sunrise.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if it's possible for them to even shoot there when the sun is up, if everything is too glaringly white.
Yeah, I think that's...
I mean, or, you know, if that's why, because it always seems to be sunset or sunrise, and it's beautiful. Absolutely gorgeous, but I was wondering if there's some sort of technical reason for that. So
no, I think that's definitely the case. That being said,
if anyone listening is a technical expert in Iceland filmography and wants to let us know, that would be amazing.
That being said, I just moved to Seattle, and it's like 9 p.m. right now in Seattle, and the sun takes like forever to set. And apparently, during summer, it's like out until like 10 p.m. at night. So I imagine in Iceland, like, the sunrises and sunsets are also protracted, but I have no idea if that's the case. I could be just totally making that up. Moving on, we got to see more of, I believe it's Harrenhal, right?
Yes.
Place where all the people are tortured and dying. And here we have, again, another awesome scene with Tywin and Arya, and just them finding out more about each other. And Arya really kind of, in my opinion, being a little bit dumb in terms of the way that she lets on how much she knows. Like, she's just a bad faker. And so, as well, she should, because why would she know anything about making an entire lie out of your existence? But, she tripped up last week in terms of where she was from, or a couple weeks ago in terms of where she's from, and she tripped up this week in terms of, like, her diction, you know? What'd you think of this series of scenes, Joanna?
Well, you know, what's interesting is she's gotten kind of cocky, and he sort of tries to take her down a peg or two. He's like, "Careful, I know you're full of shit all the time. You might as well, like, can you at least pretend, you know?" And but then he loves her, and he loves her sass. Yeah. And
let me just make a slight correction there. When he's like, "Careful," it's because she says, like, "Oh, do you know many stonemasons?" Like, because she knows that he doesn't know many stonemasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
she's sassing him.
Yeah, no, I agree with
that. Careful with your sass there.
Yeah.
But actually, secretly, I think he loves it. And I love that, you know, I think I get as many emails. I think it's a 1-to-1 ratio of people liking the show and people telling me to shut up about women's rights in Westeros.
Yeah.
But I did like how she had her, like, female heroines. Who rode on the dragons, and she knew their sword names and all that sort of stuff. I just thought that was pretty cool.
Awesome. So. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then the whole time she's doing that, I'm like, no, there's no way you could have known this as a stonemason.
Yeah.
So another series of really awesome scenes between the two of them. And, Oh, and another sort of close-up on his, like, neck, you know? Yet another close-up that's, like, meant to create tension. And I'm just like, you know what? I'm so over this. I know it's not going to happen, so just don't even try anymore. But, yeah, that was frustrating. Something else, while as much as I love this relationship, something else that I also wasn't crazy about was that we don't really get much of Arya's inner life here, because she has, in fact, like, she's what's causing Tywin to hang a ton of these innocent men. Now, granted, they're Lannisters, so I guess she's okay with them getting killed brutally. But, right, like, the reason they're being round, like, summarily executed is because they're trying to find Gregor Clegane, right? Is that correct?
No, Jaqen and H'ghar.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jaqen and H'ghar, my bad. Yeah. Gregor Clegane is the guy that was he was exchanging strategies with.
Right. Who's sort of his right hand at this point. But I don't think they know, you know, they're not trying to find Jaqen H'ghar because I don't think they know that.
Yeah,
he did
they don't
it.
Know
they're
that
just,
he did it. Yeah, they're
trying
to
find out who blew that dart.
Yeah.
And he feels like, and I think Tywin thinks it was meant for him.
Right.
You know, which is arrogant. But yes, I guess she is the cause of all this.
So wait. So my thing is, like, why is he executing his own? He's not executing townspeople, although they did agree to, like, burn their farms or whatever. But why is he executing his own men? Is what I don't understand.
Well, because it came from within.
I see. Oh yeah,
Parent
that's right.
Hall.
That's right. So, but then why execute them if they're not, like,
well, only one? I feel like he thinks only one of his own men, which Jaqen H'ghar is, could have that access.
Right.
So it has to have been one of his men, so that's why he's doing that.
No, but I'm saying clearly he hasn't killed Jaqen H'ghar yet, to our knowledge. So
right.
why is he just executing people in general? You know what I'm saying? Like, it just seems like a really inefficient way of
yeah,
doing
well,
justice.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember the inefficient way they were torturing people of the beginning of
yeah,
Empire
yeah, but,
and
but I agree with that, but I'm saying Tywin came in to kind of create order out of that chaos, and now we find out he's just as bad as that chaos. You know, basically what I'm saying is I'm disappointed in Tywin. I understand you got to burn all the townspeople and their farms and everything. That's cool. You got to send a message. But in terms of finding out the person who did it, like, what's the point of hanging all these people? Like, clearly none of them was it. Like, what is the trial process here? What is the judicial process going on is my question. Whatever it is, I think it's a travesty of justice.
You think? Well, then we can go back to Harrenhal as Abu Ghraib, as our little Abu Ghraib parallel there. So.
Yeah. Well, anyway, it's
a mockery and a sham of justice.
I would like to see some kind of reaction from Arya about all this carnage she's caused. Like, people are dying because of what she did, right? People are getting slaughtered. Innocent people are getting slaughtered and killed. Does she have a reaction? Does she feel okay with it? Does she feel guilty? Is she a sociopath? We don't really get any of that this week.
Well, like you said, it's the enemy camp. So this is not a spoiler at all to say that in the book she has an interior monologue where she thinks about trying to – that she, as Stark, should kill as many Lannisters as she can.
Right.
That is her job. So
– no, but then I believe they – when they talked with Gregor, didn't they agree that they would be killing non-Lannister people, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm talking about, is like the innocence.
The innocence,
yeah.
Okay.
All right. Then we get this nice scene between Sansa and the Hound where the Hound reveals how much of a sadist he is, I guess. And you expect this to be some tender conversation between the two. Like, in a normal show, this would be a tender conversation. But in this show, it's horrifying. What did you make of this scene?
I have not stopped cringing since on last week's episode when Miles McNutt revealed to me that there are people who believe that the Hound and Sansa should be together.
Yeah.
And they call them San-San, like Sandor and Sansa. And I think that's super creepy. And so this was sufficiently creepy where, you know, he just talks about how much he loves disemboweling. But do you believe him, or do you think he's just covering up his tender soul with disgusting violence?
Well, what was the line that he said at the end where he's like, "And I'm all that stands between you and your beloved king"? Like, I didn't really understand that. Like, he knows Joffrey's a monster. Is he saying he is going
to
protect her from him?
As much as he can.
Explicitly, he's saying it. Like, he's never said it explicitly.
Right.
But this is the first time where it's vocalized that his loyalties are to her more than they are to him in some ways. Right. So that's significant, I think. But he doesn't do it tenderly. He does it, like, angrily.
Well, I think what you could imply from or infer from that is that maybe he doesn't realize that she thinks Joffrey is disgusting. And no, he does.
Yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, you're right. He does.
Yeah.
So
I think it's a big step, I think.
All right.
Then she, like, oh my gosh. So then she relives the rape scene in her head and wakes up and finds that she has gotten her first period.
How does that make you feel, David?
How did it make me feel what?
Exactly? Yeah. That scene. Period scene.
I imagine, you know, I don't know what it's like to have a period. I imagine that Sansa went through what every woman's feels like, which is complete and utter terror and fear for her life, right? Is that how it is when you get a period?
Oh, yeah. You're like, I'm dying. God. No, I like that. I think the initial, you know, I think people initially are like, God, why are you freaking out? And then you realize that it's because she is now of, you know, childbearing age. And she has to get married to Joffrey now that they've been, you know, on the one. There are a lot of reasons why they've been waiting. And one of the reasons is to wait until she is a woman. And now she's a woman and she's freaking the fuck out because she doesn't want to marry a sadistic bastard. So
there was a character named Ralph Cifaretto in The Sopranos. Do you remember? Did you watch the show?
I did not watch The Sopranos.
Okay, okay. Well, there was a character named Ralph Cifaretto in The Sopranos. And it was a major plot point at one point in the show that Ralph Cifaretto could not have sex normally. Like, he always had some kind of weird... He didn't have conventional sex. He needed to, like, you know, beat a woman or something like that to, like, get pleasure or you know, do weird, sick, twisted stuff. And it honestly reminds me a lot of King Joffrey, because thus far we have not seen Joffrey have any of the standard sort of sexual appetites that a man his age should have. Instead, he only seems to get off on violence. And so one question I have is, can he even sort of do the deed with Sansa? That is a question that, like, I'm wondering about at this point in the show. That being said, it is also remarkable that as late as, like, season 1, episode 7, I want to say, like, a couple episodes before Ned Stark was killed,
right.
Or 6, Joffrey and Sansa's relationship was great. Like, he gave her this necklace, and he's, like, really, like, turning on the charm, you know. He's like, one day you'll be my queen and you'll rule over all the land, da 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 da. It's this touching moment, and it's like how far those characters have come in this time, you know, or even like 3 episodes later. It was such a disaster.
Well, I don't know, because that was after Cersei had that disturbing talk with him in season 1 where she was like, just marry her. Like, have sex with whoever you want. I don't care. You don't have to like her. Just be nice to her occasionally so she can give you babies, and that's it. She's like, but you're a Lannister, and we're all Lannisters, and we're the only ones we can trust. Like, she has that really distressing conversation with Joffrey, and after that, he offers Sansa the necklace, and it's super creepy because he's just like, oh, I'm doing what my mom told me, which is be nice to my little, like, broodmare here, and then I can have my creepy, violent sex with whoever I want.
So. Yeah, if it can even be called sex. But, yeah, I mean, as we discussed last week, Joanna, you know, and we'll talk about this later in this episode when we get to listener email, marriage for love is a relatively recent invention of humanity, right?
Like, true, yeah.
It used to be about property exchange. And so
sure.
So I think Cersei was totally reasonable in that scene, given that this is roughly an analog of medieval times. But also at King's Landing, Tyrion and Cersei have, like, this tender moment for the first time ever where they're actually, like, talking to each other honestly and relating to each other as, like, a brother and sister should. Pretty remarkable and very moving, you know?
Sometimes I wonder.
What?
If this is the price for what we've done, for our sins.
Sins? The Targaryens.
Wed brother and sister for hundreds of years, I know. It's what Jamie and I would say to each other in our moments of doubt. It's what I told Ned Stark when he was stupid enough to confront me. Half the Targaryens went mad, didn't they? What's the saying? Every time a Targaryen is born, the gods flip a coin.
You've beaten the odds. Tommen and Marcella are good, decent children, both of them.
It ended interestingly because it ended with this very awkward moment where he's like, should I comfort her? Should I pat her yeah. on the hand? Maybe
yeah,
I
yeah.
kind of hate her and don't trust her. And she's like, I don't really like you very much. But yeah, I think they were more honest with each other than they had been. But it's only been, I don't know, a day or whatever since she threatened to murder something that he loves. So,
right.
you know.
Speaking of murdering something that he loves, we saw how street smart Shay is in this episode. She's like, if you tell anyone, I'm going to kill you. And I was like, oh, yes, I was rooting for her. I was like, yeah, Shay's so badass. But then, of course, totally undone moments later when the Hound discovers what happened.
And does the Hound just wander into Sansa's room?
Yeah.
Time?
Well, I guess my assumption is he heard the screaming. And so, you know, or heard something. And he's like, yeah, I got to check this out, you know?
Okay, Dave, now I know that you never had this experience as a young woman getting your period for the first time. But can you imagine getting your period for the first time and then the Hound is there? You're like,
no,
what's up?
No, I can't imagine that. I also can't imagine getting my first period is equivalent to me getting married to a psychopath. That's actually harder for me to imagine than some strange dude showing up in my room in the morning.
I will have to say, I didn't think Shay was that street smart when she chased that handmaiden down because, and then she let the handmaiden go. And what is the handmaiden going to do? She's going to be like, so, Sansa's other maid is a psycho with a knife. Like she's going to tell someone, right?
Yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, so I don't know. I thought that was a kill her right then or, you know, let her go. But
yeah, but that would have been pretty hard to explain that, like, you know, the handmaiden's death. You know what I'm saying?
True.
How would you have done it is my question.
She just fell on this knife. It was, I think she was cutting some fruits.
Anyway.
Oops, her throat split open. I don't know.
All right, thank you for proving my point.
Had to do castle intrigue. I don't know.
So then we go to Robb Stark's camp, and we see Robb Stark and Alton having this conversation. And Robb tries to treat Alton Lannister well, but, you know, Stark's men are not exactly sympathetic to Alton's cause, so they're like, oh, let's put him in jail with Jaime Lannister. Nothing could go wrong with that plan. Let's put them in jail together, not restrain them very well, and not have more than one guy guarding them, really, is what their plan was there.
I don't understand why Jaime isn't, like, in a muzzle.
I was wrong a couple weeks ago. Last week, this is truly the dumbest thing that's ever happened on Game of Thrones. Like, it is just...
And in the defense of the series that I hold dear, it is completely fabricated by the series. It is not in the books at all.
It is so stupid.
It's stupid, but at the same time, the scene was great. Like, the acting in the scene was great between the two men. Like,
Go ahead, finish what you're saying.
I really loved the return of Jaime Lannister. I had missed him. But strategy-wise, the Stark men are a bunch of dumbasses because to leave the Kingslayer in this rickety cage with, you know, his hands are manacled, but he's free to move about, like, he's got an... Well, then what is that neck shackle doing? Like, he's got a neck shackle on, but, like, I don't know
What is it doing? I mean, okay, I can forgive the idea that Jaime might have gotten loose somehow. You know what I'm saying? Like, maybe he was pretending he was restrained, but he got loose. That's fine. But having just one dude guard him, and stupidly, mind you, like, that is the... Okay, I guess these guys have been watching Prison Break movies since the beginning of time, but that is the classic Prison Break trick, is, like, kill someone that you're with, wait for the person to go in, and then attack that person. That is the classic mistake that you make if you go into that jail cell while the guy's down. I mean... So dumb. This is like the Osama bin Laden of the Seven Kingdoms right now, or not the Seven, but whatever Winterfell, the North. The Osama bin Laden of the North, right? I guess would be the analogy. And you're just letting him being guarded by one dude. So dumb. I'm frustrated by how
stupid
it was.
You're disappointed.
I was very disappointed. But, you know, I guess you needed it to set in motion all of the stuff that happens in this episode. Now, I will say about that scene, I don't know if you could see what was coming, but I had a pretty clear sense that something horrible was going to happen. And there's a very specific reason for that. Whenever you watch a television show, there's a certain cadence to how the show is edited, right? And you don't really recognize it consciously, but you kind of feel it unconsciously. You feel like, oh, the show is moving along, you know, regularly and it's moving on nicely. And I remember this episode of The Shield, which I'm not going to give away what happens in it, but I was listening to the commentary and there's a scene of dialogue between these two characters. And I remember Sean Ryan, the creator of that show, saying, like, at this point, like, this scene of dialogue is like 5 minutes long. And at this point in the scene, he's like pointing out during the commentary, you realize this has gone on way longer than a scene in The Shield should go on. And something is wrong here. Like, it feels wrong when a scene goes on for that long. And I don't know in terms of time how long the scene went on, but it felt like it went on for longer than a Game of Thrones scene should go on, given what was happening in it. And therefore, it felt like something horrible was going to happen, and it did. But yes, Joanna, any further thoughts on this? It was a fantastic scene. Well done. And,
I find what you just said very interesting. Completely for me, it was as soon as Alton Lannister, completely fabricated by the show. So I keep calling him Alton Brown in my head. As soon as Alton Lannister started shuffling towards me, I'm like, no, stay in your corner. Stay in your corner. So, I mean, I thought the dialogue was great. They made reference to this character, Sir Barristan Selmy, who's been a background character throughout that entire series. But I like that they referenced him because it just makes the whole universe seem more real. You know, that Jaime has these, you know, as much as he's shining this guy on to then bash him in the head with his manacles, you know, I believe that he has these heroes like Sir Barristan Selmy and stuff like that. So, I loved that whole story. And, Jaime, like, I mean, what kind of half-cocked plan is this on Jaime's behalf? Like, he's like, all right, I'm going to kill my cousin just in case a guard comes and looks. And then in case he's just the only one, I'm going to throttle him. And then I'm going to take the keys and I'm going to sort of hop out of here in the middle of this encampment and hope nobody catches me as I hop down the road covered in my own feces, having like some sort of, you know, jail cell sores probably all over him. Like,
well, he was partially successful. Like, I mean, that the stupidity of that plan is only matched by the stupidity of the Stark men, who were unable to catch him, you know, before.
But they did.
Not before he had killed, what's his name? The guy, help me out here, Joanna.
Lord Karstark's son.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it's just stupidity all around. Then again, I mean, you could argue based on the descent that Jaime caused that his plan worked really well. Like, he knew he was in an untenable position. So he's like, I might as well make life extremely difficult for these people.
Well, it's really weird because they set up, I'm assuming something, and I'm going to try really hard not to spoil anything right now, but I'm assuming that they set that up, that scene up, so that we would then have the scene with him and Catelyn.
Right.
And that scene is in the book. And so, well, it's like...
it's okay. It's okay. Just stop. You're good.
I'm just saying that, like, I feel like you could have gotten there anyway without the prison break, but I liked the prison break. And as stupid as it was, and it reminds me of, you know, what you and I talked about on the other podcast we did, the Justified cast, where you have a very smart character guarding another very smart character and he gets out in the most preposterous way, but it's entertaining, you know? So it was a similar jailbreak, I think.
I guess. I don't know. I think both of the scenes we're referring to right now really kind of sucked. I just, like, the suspension of disbelief required is so great. You know, it just, anyway, don't want to get too much into that.
I avoided spoilers, did I not? Yes.
Yeah, no, that was good. That was good.
Thank you.
So what else we got here? Okay, so finally, right, we go to Karth, and
yes,
Daenerys is dealing with the aftermath of getting her dragon stolen.
Yes.
And so they sit the 13 down, And that is when...
Wait, first, really quickly, I want to say how adorable it was, how out of breath and distressed Sir Jorah Mormont was when he showed up and was like, I'm really sorry I wasn't here when your dragons got stolen. As lame and disgusting as people, you know, quote-unquote shipping the Hound and Sansa, I ship Sir Jorah and Dany.
We should explain what shipping is for those who don't know.
It's a quite pathetic TV watching notion when you see two characters that you really want them to get together.
Right. And I think shipping is the act of the showrunners, right? Like you say the showrunner is shipping, not the fans are shipping, right?
Oh, I think you say the fans are shipping, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
But yeah, that you know, short for relationship, I guess, and you really want those two characters to get together. That's how I feel about Jorah and Dany. I don't feel that way about the Hound and Sansa. But.
And she really has it out with him this episode too. Like, she like calls him out on his BS. Like, here's the thing: for someone who like is totally in love with Daenerys, Mormont really does talk down to her like a child. And I think you see her like reacting to that in a bad way. This episode, do you agree with me?
I do, but in his defense, she acts like a child much of the time.
Yeah, but I think she's starting to grow. Like, she finally realized, like, hey, yeah, actually, my plan is stupid. You know, like, she's like, yeah, actually, the people at King's Landing don't even know who I am. Why would they, you know, hail me as a queen? It doesn't make any sense. And she finally realizes it this episode. That being said, if you come in riding dragons, people basically have to listen to what you say.
But the dragons have to be bigger than cats.
That's right.
Which is apparently how big they are right now. So,
they schedule a meeting with the 13 to try. I believe the meeting is to try and figure out what happened to the dragons, right? Yeah. And then,
well, it's sort of a ruse by Zaro because Zaro calls the meeting.
Right. So Zaro calls the meeting, and they're like, "What's going on with the dragons?" And he basically stages a coup d'état, right?
Right.
Essentially, with the help of Pyat P, the warlock of Qarth.
Priyat Pri.
So is it Priyat with an R?
No, there's an R in his last name. I think
okay, I said Pyat Pri, right?
Yes, now yeah, okay, you
okay.
have. Yes.
Gotcha. Okay, sorry if I mispronounced that. Anyway, no, I know. Fans, I'm sure, have like the pronunciation is very important to fans, so I don't want to mess that up. So anyway, Pyat Pri does his like. The equivalent of, I think there was an X-Men character named Multiple Man. And he basically did the exact same thing as Multiple Man. He multiplied himself and killed everyone. And let me just say, I did not see that coming. So that was a pretty incredible moment when, like, all these characters who, like, you think of, like, I have thought of them as invincible, basically. Or at least very well protected. Now this warlock just goes around killing them all. It's a very shocking moment.
But there is no king of Qarth.
There is now. That was the other half of the arrangement. You would keep your gates and your minds closed to everything outside your walls. But Qarth cannot remain the greatest city that ever was if it refuses to change. I will open Qarth to the world, as I have forced it to open itself to me.
Your ambition is an inspiration. But like all upstarts, you overreach.
Three dragons the size of cats and an alliance with a charlatan do not make you a king.
An upstart and a charlatan. Empires have been built by less. Those on the margins often come to control the center, and those in the center make room for them, willingly or otherwise.
Yeah, and it's, as I've mentioned before with other Qarthian plot lines, this is not in the book at all.
Yeah.
And so I too was surprised and I liked it.
You liked it.
I did like it. I was surprised.
It really turns your crank when you see like 13 guys getting murdered simultaneously.
I think it was only 11.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Good point. Good point.
But yeah, it does turn my crank. But you know,
ten is your threshold. 10 is your threshold.
As I, you know, someone wrote into us at the end of last week that they had figured out where the dragons were. And, you know, anyone who's reading the book, even though the dragons don't get stolen in the book, anyone who's read the book knew where the dragons were in the House of the Undying. And someone said he had figured out from the, like, you know, when they do previously on before you watch a TV show and they show something that you're like, oh, well, now I know this is going to be in the episode. Thanks a lot. So some guy was like, they showed the House of the Undying on previously on. So that's where the dragons have to be. So it's true. I'm really excited to find out how or if Dany is going to get her dragons back from the House of the Undying. I think that's going to be a very interesting part of the show.
I agree. I think that will be very interesting to see if and how that plays out. Some things on this scene I'm not 100% clear on, Joanna, is... So first of all, Mormont has this conversation with this woman who has all this crap all over her face. And she says to him, do not betray her again. Meaning a couple things. First of all, she knows, like, she's magical enough that she knows what's going on there. Like, she knows his past, so she's, like, psychic in some way. Obviously, there's a lot of magic going on at Qarth. Any reservations I had about the magic in the show need to be put away, given what we've learned. So she's like, don't betray her again. And this is referring to the fact that Jorgha Mormont was originally sent to spy on her, right? And but then afterwards, Robert Baratheon was like, sent him a message that's like, hey, you're free of your debt. And then he's like, okay, well, I'm free of my debt, but I still like this chick, so I'm going to stay with her, right? Is that essentially what happened?
Yes, essentially.
Yeah, and he like, that's shortly after he's released from his debt is when he saves her from being assassinated, if my recollection is correct.
But yeah, initially he's there to inform on her movements to Robert Baratheon.
Gotcha.
So that was the initial betrayal, was, you know, when Robert receives that message at the beginning of season one, where he's like, you know, the Targaryen bitch, or whatever charming thing he calls her, has wedded, you know, herself to a Khalasar, you know, like.
He's the one that's feeding him all that information.
Right, exactly. Yep. So he did betray her, but, you know, he swears that he never will again. And we all believe him because we want them to be together, right?
Right, I guess.
Right? Kind of.
He is a little old for her, in my opinion, but
yeah,
whatever.
In the book, he's way older. It's creepy in the book. But in the TV show, Ian Glenn, who plays Ser Jorah Mormont, is quite dashing, I think. So it's a different thing. Guys. I'll stop talking about Jorah and Dany.
What I didn't understand is that, like, so Zorro's intention is to seize control of Qarth, and he does this by killing all the 13, or the remainder of the 13. And, like, Pyat Pree, like, he is helping Zorro, right? And so the purpose of taking the dragons is what exactly? It's not entirely clear to me. Like, okay. I get it.
Here's the deal that I believe they made.
Yeah.
Is that Pyat Pree wants to get Dany into the House of the Undying.
Uh-huh.
That's important to him.
For reasons that we don't know yet.
Right. So he's kidnapped her dragons and taken them to the House of the Undying to lure her there. And Zorro wants Pyat Pree's help to assassinate the rest of the 13.
Right.
And so he's like, okay, here's the deal. You can have the dragons for your little plot as long as you help me with my little throat-cutting plot over here. And then I will be the king of Qarth. And it will be awesome because I will let all the immigrants in and Qarth will be amazing. So,
what I don't understand is, and I do like that speech that he gives about the margins becoming the mainstream.
Right.
That was pretty cool. And Alan Sepinwall, in his review of the show, pointed out that it very much is mirroring what's going on in this show, where characters who you thought were totally secondary in the first season have now become the main characters of this season. And that's pretty remarkable to see happen. It's exhilarating when a show can do that. And
what were his examples? Who were his examples?
Oh, well, like Theon, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, that's not a major character. Arguably Rob, you know, was not a huge presence in season one, although I don't recall offhand, but I guess that's kind of a sign. So, I did like that. That's kind of what the show is doing, and very few shows can pull that off effectively. The Wire being one of them. But other than that, you know, very few shows can take what you thought was a totally secondary character and make them the main star. So Zorro seizes control of Qarth, and yay for him. Okay, so my issue with that, Joanna, is like, dude, if this Pyat Pree character can just, like, if he can be multiple man, I mean, anyone with that power is basically invulnerable and invincible, right? Like, he can just do anything. Why does he need freaking Zaro's help is my question. I don't know if this question is going to be answered later on, but I will just say, like, anyone who has a power like that, why do they need to partner with anyone? Do you know what I'm saying? It baffles my mind.
I will say that the guy who is playing, I don't know the actor's name, unfortunately, but the guy who's playing Pyat Prey is doing a fantastic job. He is super creepy. And there was so much menace. Like, even though I know things that other people don't know, there was so much menace in that scene when, you know, Dany and the remaining, you know, her remaining people were trying to get out of there and he was blocking the way. I was supremely deeply disturbed. So it was, I thought that was a great sequence of events.
Pyat Prey is a character actor who is British, and he's played by a man named Ian Hanmore, just so people know.
Fantastic.
So he does a great job. And I think that is pretty much the entire episode with one exception, and that is the final scene between Catelyn and Brienne and Jaime. And Jaime just freaking taunting Catelyn, because Jaime knows that, like, I mean, from my perspective, Jaime wants them to kill him, right? He wants, or he thinks it would be a net positive if he were killed, which is why he doesn't care about taunting the people that have trapped him, right? That's my perspective. I don't know if you have any insight into that.
I don't feel it's safe to comment on that, but I will say that there are a few interactions that happen in the book that I would be very upset if they were missing from the show, and this was one of them. And actually, they spent a lot of Jamie's like awesomeness in that earlier sequence.
Yep.
When in the book, in this interaction with Catelyn, he is like coming on to her. I mean, he is just being super obnoxious. He's like, "You want to have sex? Is that why you're here? Like, what's going on?" You know? And so I think they toned down, as hard as it is to believe, because he was taunting her with, Jon Snow and stuff like that. Like, it's even more, like, he's even 1 foot over the line more so in the books. So, and we don't know what's going to happen next. So,
yeah. So he already is pretty obnoxious in that scene, Joanna. So I can't imagine what he was like in the books, but, this episode ends with a really ambiguous note, which is, did Theon kill the kids and burn them to death? Is Catelyn going to kill Jaime, right? I mean, she's facing a situation where if Jaime doesn't die, then her men may tear themselves apart before Rob arrives at the camp to kind of restore order. Speaking of Rob, by the way, so I guess they have this, like, in my opinion, that love story is kind of dumb. Like,
it's super dumb.
It's not. I don't find it compelling or interesting at all. I don't know why I don't. I mean, it has the kind of ingredients of what should be a decent love story, but something about it, man, it's just not convincing to me.
But once again, the virginal Stark boys are, you know, Rob, like I said, may not be a virgin in the show, but the semi-quasi-virginal Stark boys are just so awkward. You know what I mean? He's like, or the Stark and the Snow boys. He's like, why don't you come with me? It would be awesome if you just came with me.
Yeah, just
you know, and it's like, so I'm cringing, you know, yeah. I'm like, Rob, cool it a little bit. You are king of the North. Play it cool. Do it. You got this. It's okay.
You're so money, man.
You don't even know.
Exactly. You're like a bear. And he's looking at his paws. Anyway.
She's like this little bunny. She doesn't know. She doesn't know.
So what else is going on? So in terms of what was I going to bring? Oh, yeah. So there, one of my favorite scenes of Game of Thrones, I don't know why I love it so much, but in season one, there's that scene when Catelyn promises Rob to one of that dude's daughters.
Right.
And like in exchange for passage of his army. Do you remember what that guy's name is called?
Frey.
Yeah, Frey. And it is hilarious because, you know, he asks her, like, are any of them like decent looking? And she's like, she can't even say yes. She's like, there was one that was, and then she just trails off. And it was hilarious.
She's because, like, in the dark.
The dark, it all doesn't make a difference, right?
Yeah.
That was awesome. So I just think of that scene whenever I see Rob and Talisa together. Like, hey, dude, your promise to that average-looking one.
And didn't I think Catelyn sort of brought that up last episode, where she's like, you've got duties to fulfill as a king and prince. Yeah, so...
Although really,
yeah,
like,
you don't get to go around have sex with every hot nurse you see, Rob.
Dude, he's got to take Cersei's advice here and, you know, marry her and just, you know, have sex with whoever else he wants. That's really the way to go for Rob, I think.
Right? Like, have sex with her in the dark with all of the curtains drawn, no candles, and, you know, to produce some heirs. And
You seem like you have a lot of experience with this, Joanna. Anyway,
with betting an unattractive female,
yeah, that's exactly what I was going with that. Anyway, let's move on. So the series ends on this really, the episode ends on this really like uncertain note. I can't wait to see what happens next week. I thought this was a great episode, Joanna. What say you?
I didn't think it was the strongest episode of the season, but book wise, I think what's interesting is they've shuffled some storylines to set up. Like, the biggest set pieces are yet to come. We've only got 3 more episodes. There's so much left and big stuff. So
yeah, are they going to be able to pull it off? All of it off is the question.
I'm saying if they do everything that they have left to do, the next 3 episodes are going to be nail biting, teeth clenching, amazing. So.
All right, I'm looking forward to it. Anyway. That's our review of Season 2, Episode 7 of Game of Thrones. Let's get to emails, Joanna.
Let's
read some emails, all right? You can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Brant Rumpel writes in, I'm listening to older episodes, and I had to comment on your remark about the men of the Night's Watch commenting on how good the wildling women look. You said something to the effect that those women are not very attractive and wearing tons of furs, so you can't really see anything, and the guys are saying how they love to watch women walk away. Which translated into modern speak sounds like, oh, damn, girl, look at you go. Well, I was traveling in the Middle East for 4 months last year, and for the first 2 months, I was in Egypt and Jordan, where you don't see women. I don't know where they are or what they're doing, but you don't talk to women, you don't interact with women, and when you do see women, they are covered from head to toe. So after a while, you see a girl without a headscarf, and you can see her hair blowing in the wind and perhaps a bit of her neck showing, and I was thinking the same things as the men of the Night's Watch. It's really ridiculous what has an effect on you when you don't see women for months. So that scene is totally understandable to me. And I think Brand is right here. It is weird, like, when... I guess in cultures where women are more covered up, like, when they're not covered, it's more enticing. You know what I mean? So really, that scene, Joanna, even though you were mocking it, does say something about human nature and about male nature specifically, no?
Sure. It was just funny. I will say that they have given Ygritte more form-fitting furs than they gave Craster's wives, sister wives, daughter wives in the earlier episodes. She's got a little bit of shape on her, so that wilding. But
there you go.
Yes.
All right, here we go. So let's see. What else? We got an email from Glenn from Lismore, Australia. In regard to the fact we don't see any major battles because it's cost prohibitive to pull off on TV, my question is for Joanna. Are the major battles described in detail in the books, or is it like the TV where there's only a passing reference to what has gone on? As a fan of the show, are we really missing that much by not seeing a battle? You see one, you've seen them all, and we've all seen the Lord of the Rings movies. I'm more interested in the politics and the banter, so personally, I don't see that I'm missing out on anything. What do you think, Joanna?
I think like the 2 battles that people have complained that we've skipped over were, Rob's great victory, where you just see sort of the direwolf go after some men and then cut to black, and then the aftermath, and then the sacking of Winterfell. And neither of those events are described in great detail in the book. There is a battle upcoming that is described in great detail. And as Miles McNutt and I were talking about, and hopefully this is not a spoiler, we're hoping that it's coming in the show. But no, I don't think you're missing that much, because a lot of it is told through hearsay. It's like, you know, did you hear about this battle that Rob Stark was victorious? And I heard that, you know, he changed shape and his direwolf did this and that sort of stuff. So, you know, George R. R. Martin does not spend a lot of time describing battles, so that when he does, it has that impact, you know?
Yeah. All right. Let's see. I'm trying to find some emails from last week before I read off this last one from this week, which you know what that one's going to be. But let's see here. In terms of emails from last week. So first of all, I want to thank all the people that emailed in supporting my right to actually do a show on Game of Thrones. That was very nice because we have also had a lot of people commenting and emailing about how stupid I am. And so it's nice when people say, hey, you know what, Dave, I actually am also slightly confused at what goes on Game of Thrones. So thank you guys for writing in. I will continue doing this show at least until the end of this season. Let's see what else we got here. Okay. One question that someone asked that I thought was really insightful was when I made a comment the other week about how I feel like the show's coming apart at the seams. And I said, someone wrote in, Peter Herf wrote in, I can tell you exactly why the show's falling apart at the seams. There is no clear protagonist. Robb Stark is cool enough, but is probably a character that works better in novels than in the show. The moment Sean Bean's head came off, I started to worry. So what do you think of this, Joanna?
I think it's interesting. It's something that you and I talked about, I think, in the very first episode of the podcast about wondering who would be the quote-unquote hero of the series. And I think both of us had somewhat settled on Tyrion sort of taking that role, taking up that mantle.
Well, I don't know if I had, but I think you had.
Oh, okay. All right. But I wonder once again, as we've mentioned a couple times this episode, if it's weirdly Theon, if that's weirdly like the central figure of this season, and if he's not someone that we can root for, is that the wisest choice, you know, to make as your central figure? You know?
Right. Yeah. But it is cool. I mean, so first of all, I mean, you already had the guy trying to be noble as your central figure, right? Why not have a guy who's descending into the depths of madness and kind of masculine frustration as your central figure? You know, I like that they're trying something new. That being said, yeah, it does kind of hearken to this idea that we like shows and properties and films or whatever where there is a guy we can root for who's on the side of good. Like, that is cool to have. The issue, I think one of the issues is, like, Theon is not even an anti-hero. You know what I'm saying? Like, you have a show like The Sopranos or what do you call it? The Shield. Those are anti-heroes. And
right.
Like, you can root for them and feel conflicted about it, but you're still rooting for them. Theon is not even an anti-hero, in my opinion. He's just like a villain at this point.
I completely agree.
Yeah. So
you can definitely have characters on show who do reprehensible things or morally ambiguous things, and they're either so charming or compelling, or their story is so oddly relatable, you know, that you end up, you know, yeah, that's an anti-hero. I haven't watched Breaking Bad, but I've heard that the main character on that show started as an anti-hero to a certain extent and sort of has become so mired in his decisions that I think people are having a harder and harder time relating to the Walter
White
character.
I think that's a good description of things. And it is very difficult to root for that character. And I don't even know if people are rooting for him at this point. I know I am actually not, personally. So,
right. But people are still watching and loving that show.
Yeah,
so
people will watch and love Game of Thrones, even if Theon is the main character. But yeah, it does take something away when you don't have it does take some a je ne sais quoi away when you don't have a main character you can root for.
Right.
Okay, so as promised, we got tons of emails that are just, in my opinion, just a couple steps away from misogynistic. And let's read some of them out. Well, here's one. Brandon from PDX writes in, Joanna, we get it. Please, no more women's liberation soapbox stuff. Game of Thrones is fantasy, but parallels our world circa many hundreds of years ago. Fair to say it was more of a man's world, and how women act and treated seem time appropriate. Please limit the soapboxing about women not getting a fair shake to another podcast. I mean, Joanna, my question is, how did you even have enough time away from the kitchen to record this podcast?
Here's the deal. The cord on my microphone is really long, so I can actually do this podcast from the kitchen.
That makes sense.
You know?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
I can only hope that while you were recording a Cast of Kings, you were preparing a nice pot roast for a man. Presumably.
For my fella, of course.
Your fella, of course. Because otherwise you would be, I mean, really going against social norms here. So, all right. But no, we got a lot of emails that are basically like, Joanna, just stop complaining. Here's another email. Cord, from DC writes in, it's clear you have a very strong feminist perspective. From episode one onward, you've commented on circumstances of the show that you feel portray women in a negative or unnecessarily gratuitous light. Considering that the show is very graphic and clearly there's no women's rights movement in the Seven Kingdoms, I'd like to know how you reconcile your feelings with those scenarios you take exception to, both from the books and the show, while still enjoying the story and co-hosting a podcast. From my perspective, with each episode, you have an issue with a scene or with a character, and that issue is primarily about the treatment of a female or depiction of a female, and you are imposing your expectation of fair and proper treatment of a woman based on our culture versus that of George R.R. Martin's fictional cultures. I have a lot to say about this, Joanna, but obviously it's about you, so what do you say in response?
No, I'm interested to hear what you say. I actually emailed Cord back because I thought he raised some interesting points, but I thought he missed the mark a little bit, which is that I agree that I do tend to talk a lot about, you know, the depiction of women. It's an issue that's obviously important to me, but I feel like where it usually comes up is when there's a difference between the book and the TV show, and when that difference results in, you know, the hypersexualization of women.
Yep.
I have no problem with George R. R. Martin's text. I think he writes fantastic, strong, awesome women. I think he writes about, you know, a culture that is, you know, the sexual mores are different from our own, but he writes some very, very interesting female characters in that. HBO has taken some liberties with that text, which is, you know, fine, they're right. It's also my right to disagree with the way in which they've translated some of the characters. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I mean, I think that's what, like, I'll be honest, I've like almost physically, if I wasn't so inured to stupidity via email from listeners occasionally, not most listeners, just some, if I wasn't so inured to it, I would physically get angry at these emails because it's not even like they're saying, I disagree with you. It's like they're saying you don't even have the right to have an opinion on this. And that is what I find truly infuriating, is that people are saying, yeah, why are you even commenting on this? You shouldn't comment on this, Joanna. And I mean, that's just, it's, I I'm at a loss for words right now. I'm so angry thinking about it. Ultimately, I think that there is some truth to be found in these emails, that yes, obviously, this is a world where it mirrors like the medieval ages of our world, where women had far fewer rights, you know, and they're basically treated as property. And the show reflects that, and it should reflect that, right? But the issue I think that Joanna has, and the issue that I have, and that the issue that I'm guessing some feminists may have, is that first of all, this show, Game of Thrones, the television show, does not emerge into a cultural vacuum. You know what I mean? Like, despite what is happening in the world of the books, or in the past world, like it does come out in our world where there is a lot of sort of cultural baggage to showing women naked and sexualized and abused and exploited, right? Like you cannot ignore that, and I think Joanna's comments reflect that in a lot of ways. And then of course there's the other point that Joanna already made, which is that it seems like if there's an opportunity to make a woman into a sexualized creature, that the show takes it rather than tries to avoid it. And
right.
And yeah, and there's a difference between showing like a stark reality, no pun intended, of what's going on in these books and sort of putting in, you know, layering in gratuitous nudity and sex.
Right.
You can make an argument that there's a certain artfulness to showing nudity and sex. Like you don't need to show it when it's not necessary. You don't show it when it distracts. Like why show it when you know the scene is perfectly fine without it, right? Unless you're really just using it to titillate and to grab attention and to sensationalize what would otherwise be, you know, maybe a boring scene. I don't know what their motivation is, but the point is like that. Even if it's okay for women to be abused and exploited in the world of the books, that it's kind of not okay in today's world. And I think you arguably see that happening through the show to some degree. But go ahead, John. What are you going to say?
Well, the other thing that I object to is the like you've talked about before, the implication that I'm stupid, that I don't understand, that it's set in an alternate universe where women do not have the right to vote or whatever. But it's not like I don't think I'm that stupid in terms of like I will watch Mad Men and I won't go, oh my God, this show is so sexist and it hates women. No, they're portraying a sexist society, as is this, you know, show to a certain extent, except you've got some of the coolest women on television are on this show. You've got Brienne and Arya, like really awesome, strong women. But as you said, when the show has an opportunity to show a naked woman, as in last week with the OSHA plotline, her getting naked and having sex rather than fighting her way out of a scenario, it takes it. And I think Miles McNutt brought up last week that that's sort of the like pay cable way of like, you know, well, you're paying for this because we can show nudity and violence and that sort of stuff. You're paying for that kind of entertainment. And, you know, Dave and I are both huge fans of the show. We love the show. Otherwise, we would not create a podcast for it. But it's still okay to have to take exception with certain aspects.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And you may disagree and not take exception. That's fine. But like everyone has the right to have an opinion about it, you know? So anyway, it was very distressing, Joanna, to read these emails. And hopefully I am going to assume that the majority of our listeners don't feel the way that these people feel about feminism. I will say also that something that popped into my head that I know is not a good argument, but that it popped into my head anyway, is that hey, maybe that would, like, the fact that it's set in an alternate fantasy universe is an opportunity to not have women subject to the same barbaric rules that they were back in the medieval ages on Earth.
Right, I mean, plenty of fantasy authors have done.
But that being said, it's like, I don't want to question George R. R. Martin's choices in that, you know what I'm saying? Like he created it this way because he felt it would be the best way to tell the story. So I don't want to say like, oh, well, he's wrong. But that is something that occurred to me. But I mean, that's just a thought, is a passing thought that is somewhat related to what we're talking about. Anyway, so
I will get off my women's
dismount from your high horse, Joanna.
Yes. I will clamber down from my soapbox now. So.
All right. Sounds good. Anyway, thank you guys for listening to this week's episode of Cast of Kings. You can find all of our episodes at GameOfThronesPodcast.com. Email us again at acastofkings@gmail.com. Joanna Robinson, where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me every day over on pajiba.com, and I'm going to spell it because I found out people don't know what that is, which is pajiba.com. Or you can follow me over on Twitter at @QuitYourJRob.
You can find me at twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, SKY, DaveChen.net. Find my other podcasts at /filmcast.com and TobolowskiFiles.com. Thank you guys for listening to this week's episode of A Cast of Kings. We'll see you later.